Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's not easy to write about the Midwest, and frankly, not as many people have tried compared to writers exploring what it means to be from the South or New York City or California, for example. Megan O'Giblin has a newly released collection of essays. It's called Interior States, and it explores her upbringing in an evangelical family, her life in a Midwestern town, and her viewpoint from the middle of what some people consider nowhere. Tonight at 7 p.m., the AME Allen Chapel hosts the author for a reading and audience Q&A. Wednesday, November 14th, she's at Zambros Variety in Sioux Falls. That's at 7 p.m. Megan O'Giblin lives in Wisconsin. Her essays have appeared in Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, The Guardian, Oxford American, Plowshares, NewYorker.com, The Point, and Tin House, and they've been included in the Pushcart Prize anthologies and in the Best American Essays 2017. She joins us now from SDPB's Vermilion Studios. Megan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, your list of credits, and that's not all of them, I should say, is making a lot of writers sort of sit up and pay attention. Did you always want to sort of be a writer with those kind of credits to your name? How did you get, from where you were to here?
Yeah, well, it's funny because when I was growing up, I grew up in evangelical family, and so we actually didn't read those magazines that weren't, we didn't subscribe to Harper's and the New Yorker and all of these magazines that I've ended up writing for now, so it wasn't an aspiration. I did write as a child, and I started writing fiction, actually, when I was in Bible school. I went to Moody Bible Institute when I was 18 years old, which is this very small, very conservative Christian college in Chicago. Mm. And ended up experiencing a lot of what I call a crisis of faith while I was there. I had a lot of doubts about the religion in which I was raised and ended up leaving the church altogether and started writing or continued writing throughout that time, fiction and nonfiction, as a way to sort of process that experience and to make sense of it. Because it was a very isolating experience. I had grown up in this community where everyone I knew believed the same thing. And then to leave that was a very jarring experience. So I went to an MFA program and was writing fiction there and also doing a little bit of nonfiction on the side, and then sort of transitioned over more and more to nonfiction because I wanted to tell my own story without, I think in fiction I was always trying to write about my experience by disguising it. A character's experience, that the character that was identical to me, a young girl who was at Bible school. And it turned out I could write more directly about those experiences through the form of the personal essay. And I'm really fortunate. A lot of magazines have been interested in that experience. And it seems like a lot of readers, too, have resonated with that experience of being in a faith community and then leaving it. So that's been interesting to hear from readers as well.
And you use the word in the introduction to Interior States, testimony. This is my testimony, and that means something specific. So explain to listeners why you chose to use that word as you talk about this notion of essays and confession versus testimony.
Yeah, I guess I've always been interested in this common criticism of personal writing, both personal essays and memoir, that it's a confessional genre. And this is usually used by people who are kind of deriding personal writing for being navel-gazing or being too self-indulgent. And it's interesting to me that that is a religious term. When you call writing confessional, the implication is that the writer is unburdening themselves the way that they would to a priest, say, and looking for absolution of some kind. And what's interesting to me as somebody who grew up in a very religious home is that we actually did not practice confession as Protestants. That was a form that was alien to me. I think in many ways I envy that experience of people who are Catholic and who could go and, tell all of their wrongdoings and their sins to a priest and be granted forgiveness and, okay, you're back at zero now. Yeah. And so I started thinking, I guess around the time I was putting these essays together is, okay, well, if the confessional form is alien to me, what is the narrative form that is sort of in my DNA, so to speak, as a former evangelical? And the narrative form that was really familiar to me was the idea of giving testimony. And this is, I guess as distinct from confession, testimony is a public form. The idea is that you would stand in front of the congregation and tell the story of your life, particularly of your conversion. And it was also a form of argument. You know, it takes its name from the courtroom testimony. The idea is that you're providing evidence of how your life was changed by God. And I think in some sense, these essays, even though I'm writing about my deconversion experience in a lot of the essays as opposed to my conversion experience, I think they do function as testimonies. And to the extent that they're written, and I'm always trying to put my experience, my personal life, in conversation with larger public debates. Mm-hmm. They're also, I would hope, a lot of the essays make an argument of some kind, or I hope to, you know, unsettle the premises of arguments that I disagree with. So, in the preface, I talk about how the essays are, I think, more testimony than confession.
Yeah. To be a former believer is to perpetually return to the scene of the crime. Those are your words. And let's talk a little bit about that sense that, you know, there is a deconversion experience. And yet, as I'm reading this, it seems like, well, nobody could write as incisively about this as you, not only because of your experience as a child, your experience as an adult, but the amount of education and theological wrangling that you have done in your life. Do you ever want to walk away from it all? You keep coming back to sort of looking at these broader conversations that are happening in America and saying, okay, well, what about this?
Yeah, I do think about walking away from it. I think every time I finished one of the essays that ended up in the collection, I vowed that I wasn't going to write about Christianity anymore. And I did, you know, a lot of the essays are about other topics, too. I write a lot about the Midwest, but somehow Christianity gets in there. It's, again, just such a deep part of my experience. And the questions that I was struggling with as a Christian and when I left the faith are just feel like they're very deeply embedded in my psyche, and I think I'm always returning to them again and again in my writing. Both not just to figure out, I mean, I am curious about what's happening within evangelicalism and how that culture has been changing politically and culturally over the past few years. So there's sort of an anthropological interest that persists. But I also am interested in how aspects of secular culture are sort of imbued with religious undertones or religious mythology. I think, you know, as a nation, America is becoming much more secular. I think it's particularly among young people, there's been some studies that say that more young people identify as non-religious or as nones, N-O-N-E-S. They choose none under a religious category than ever before. And yet I think that we, you know, put our faith in these aspects of life in sort of transformative experience of various kinds or in narratives about the future that take on almost sort of a religious aspect.
At some point when you sort of achieve a certain amount of recognition, the feedback must be that people have an expectation of what they want you to say about the Midwest, what they want you to say about faith. Either they want you to be more positive. You're not a negative writer, but, you know, they might say, well, what about this or something? Or somebody might say, what about this from the opposite standpoint? At some point, other people have an idea of what they think they want you to say. How do you stay true to your own experience, your own voice, as everybody looks at your work and wants to sort of adjust it to their own point of view? Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of the essays actually started, like, the inspiration for them was this idea that people were writing in the larger culture, people were writing about both Christianity and the Midwest in a way that felt very one-dimensional to me and very dismissive. I think particularly in the lead up to the 2016 election, there was a lot of stories in major coastal newspapers about the Midwest that made it seem politically monolithic, that it was to some extent synonymous with the white working class. And I think my writing about the Midwest really grew out of a desire to complicate that narrative and call attention to other aspects of the region that were being overlooked. And the same thing with Christianity, I think. You know, a lot of my writing about evangelicalism was, I don't know, it grew out of a desire to complicate the idea that Christianity was a form of wishful thinking, that the only people who subscribed to those beliefs were, you know, sort of belonged to medieval superstition, superstitious worldviews, and that they weren't rational and couldn't defend their beliefs. And as somebody who had believed this, you know, up until my mid-20s, I knew that that wasn't true. And I think for the most part, I mean, since I've published the essays, I have heard, you know, some people who want to pigeonhole those topics into the more familiar patterns or the more familiar narratives about the Midwest or the Christianity. I think all of us are drawn to familiar stories because it doesn't unsettle our existing worldview. But I've also been really encouraged to hear people who, you know, are really happy to hear these topics written about with ambivalence. And it turns out there's a lot of people who likewise have ambivalent feelings or more complex feelings about those topics as well.
I think a lot of people who already know you have read this essay that you wrote about the rebranding of hell and the concept of hell. And for those who haven't read it, let's talk a little bit about how you decided to take a look at how the church and the way that it communicated the notion of eternal damnation was evolving and changing and, you know, being blown out of the water by some pastors like Rick Warren and Rob Bell, and really what that means. So why hell? Why did you decide that that was something worth really being a social critic on as far as how the church was managing it?
Yeah. Well, I guess the starting point for that essay was my own personal experience. So that was hell, the theology of hell, the doctrine of hell was something I really struggled with as a student of theology. Just the idea that, you know, how could a loving God send the vast majority of people who were ever created to spend eternity in hell, which was, as a fundamentalist, that was the version of damnation that I was taught. And so I do write about that experience in the essay. The other part of it, which I became interested in during the writing process, was the fact that evangelical pastors around the turn of the millennium basically became very reticent about talking about hell from the pulpit. And I had noticed this when I was still going to churches and when I went back and visited my parents' church. I noticed that all of a sudden, you know, I had grown up with this very traditional understanding of fire and brimstone. Pastors didn't have a lot of fear in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s talking about this idea, and that drastically changed you know, around the time that I was leaving the church. So doing some research, I discovered that this was actually, it grew out of this concerted movement called the Seeker Church Movement, which was a movement of evangelical pastors who decided they were going to start running their churches like businesses. And so they would go out into the community and do market research and ask, you know, ask people in the community, why aren't you going to church? Why don't you like going to church? And people would say, well, I don't like being told that I'm a sinner, and I don't like hearing about hell. So the pastors just decided not to preach on this very essential part of Christian doctrine. And so I write about that. And in writing about that, I was forced to confront the question of, well, what is the value of hell? Which is not a question I really wanted to answer as a writer, because, you know, nobody wants to say that hell is a good thing. But it is necessary, I think, for the Christian gospel to make sense. You know, you can't be saved if there's nothing to be saved from. And so the essay kind of explores different ways in which hell has been interpreted across the span of Christian history, and offers, you know, ways that I guess pastors could have used hell as a metaphor, or sort of tried to keep it within their Christian tradition as opposed to just abandoning it.
And before I let you go, we should also say it's a very insightful book in the moment that we're living in right now, too. And you have an essay now I can't remember exactly what it's called, but near the end of the book about Mike Pence as vice president, and this criticism or question mark that a lot of people had about how, with Mike Pence's religious background, could he tie his wagon to President Trump or candidate Donald Trump when there were questions about his ethics and you know, his sort of behavior. And you do this wonderful look at the story of Daniel in the lion's den and King Nebuchadnezzar. And, you know, it's sort of a look not only at the theology there, but at the moment that we're in right now and what it means for some of the policies that we see coming out of the White House and in the Republican Party, as this conversation is so dynamic at this particular point in history. It's not really a question. That's just insight.
You blew my mind with that. Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, that was a difficult piece to write, but it was really interesting to see the extent to which, yeah, evangelicals were really latching onto these Old Testament stories, like about Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, and applying them to the current political landscape.
Yeah. The book is called Interior States, and Megan O'Giblin is going to be at the AME Allen Chapel tonight at 7 p.m. Wednesday on November 14th. That's tomorrow. She's at Zambros Variety in downtown Sioux Falls. Also at 7. Megan, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.